Okay, so I go ahead. So thank you very much for the invitation. Pleasure to be virtually at RAL. Some people actually I know very well at RAL. I used to be in the UK for a long time in the past. I did my PhD not far from RAL. So there you go. Big pleasure. So this time, I mean, not long ago, I told you about Liquido. So this time, I mean, we decided to tell you more about the reactive neutrinos and maybe how Liquido would work into that with a little bit of a teaser of how to use Liquido maybe elsewhere. So this is what the seminar is about. So when it comes to reactors, this started a long time ago. I think people know neutrinos were discovered by Reines and Cohen et al. In the 50s. Actually, these guys, with the discovery, of course, they proved Pauli right. And but not only that, they actually, at the time, they also paved the ground of much of the neutrino technology that we have even today. Liquid scintillator detectors and even Cherenkov detectors are, roughly speaking, what we was started at the time. They didn't use the Cherenkov light. I mean, mainly they use scintillators, but nonetheless, if you actually look at these kind of detectors, they are just basically a little bit of a perturbation of one to the other. So these guys actually amazingly did a lot of that work. This is the picture of what neutrino collaborations were looking like at the time of the neutrino discovery. And these guys actually really, I mean, it's worth talking about them for long, but I'm not going to do that. I mean, I'm just going to actually try to basically highlight that what they actually did, I mean, setting the transparent liquid scintillator approach is exactly what we're going to try to break a little bit, or at least challenge with Liquido. But you would see that this transparent strategy has got us very far away. There you go. So one of the key things that we actually use when it comes to reactor neutrinos, we have a beautiful interaction that is very well understood, where an antineutrino coming from the nuclear reactor, this is typically coming from any nuclear essentially decay, is going to interact with protons in the target that would be in water or liquid scintillator. So liquid scintillator is just carbon, hydrogen, and carbon. So we're just going to interact these neutrinos with the hydrogen, and it's going to manifest interaction as a coincidence. So this is going to give us a bang bang, basically interaction in the detector. The prompt is a positron that is going to very quickly essentially deposit some energy, some just ddx is essentially a MIP, essentially these kind of energies, and then it's going to annihilate, and this is a beautiful first prompt. And then we have a neutron that is going to wander. This is very low energy, typically kV. It's going to wander in the detector. It's just going to thermalize, and eventually it's going to capture essentially, and this can capture on the hydrogen itself, but also sometimes, I mean, people has been hunting these, improving the capturing of these neutron using lithium, gadolinium, you name it. I mean, there are many ways to do that. And the idea was to really keep this coincidence, this beautiful coincidence on the microsecond level. And that is basically a key strategy that it was used at the time of the discovery to really get, I mean, the background well controlled. Now, actually, Reines and Cohen actually use a little bit of positron identification, but since then, essentially nobody has been able to practically do that in a regular basis in neutrino detectors. So the reality is that these detectors, very often, when it comes to this beautiful positron antimatter, being very different from mundane matter that manifests in natural radioactivity, essentially we cannot identify this positron. So essentially, a positron in our detectors and a gamma, an electron, an alpha, a proton recoil, it looks alike. And in fact, all our backgrounds, in fact, are that particular problem. And this is why we put the detectors typically deep underground to avoid these kind of things. And we actually clean the detectors, radio purity, I mean, to avoid some of these backgrounds. So in fact, I mean, if we were able to do this positron PID, that in fact, that would be wonderful. And in fact, that's exactly what we want to try to do with Liquido. So you will see how we do that. So reactors also have a beautiful capability, and you can switch them on and switch them off. And that actually is very beautiful. What you see here is the spectra of the reactors, the reactor spectra. So this is a neutrino. So this is MeV. And what you're going to see is now how the reactor is going to switch off. As a matter of fact, it goes basically reactor off for a certain while. This data, this is actual data. This is not simulation. This is data from double slow, where we have subtracted the background. You can see essentially the little fluctuations after background subtraction. And you can see essentially there is a little bit of neutrinos here. And this is because the neutrinos, the reactor emits neutrinos even when there is no essentially reactor running. And now the reactor is going to go up essentially. And you can see we can monitor the reactor power. That's what you actually see on the other side. So we're able to really see this beautiful one-to-one relation between neutrinos and the thermal power of the nuclear reactor. others. So this is so cool that even our friends from the sun, they are wondering, can we switch off the sun? Essentially, it will be done so we can measure the patterns. Unfortunately, that's far too cool. And this remains a dream of a few, and clearly not with that many disadvantages if that was to happen. Now, let me just talk a little bit of reminder on neutrino oscillations, because we're going to talk about some of that. So as you know, neutrino oscillations comes down essentially to the manifestation, the macroscopical manifestation of two pieces of physics. One of them, that is basically the non-degenerate mass spectra of the neutrinos, allows for quantum interference basically manifesting in the kilometer and even thousands of kilometer basically scale. And the other basically piece of physics that has to basically be happening is that neutrinos actually basically are mixing. So we actually cannot basically see the manifestation of oscillation without these two pieces of physics actually sort of working at the same time. And in fact, when we actually basically characterize neutrino oscillations, we actually characterize in two typical parameters. One of them is actually the mixing, and the other one is this quantum interference, in fact. And when we actually see neutrino oscillations, this says there is mixing. I lost my mouse. There is mixing, but there is also basically neutrinos have to be massive. So you can actually characterize this by a very simple simple equation where you have the amplitude basically here. So this is basically the amplitude of your oscillation equation, and this is the phase of your oscillation equation. And this can be essentially seen by, imagine you started with a certain neutrino blue, and this neutrino blue is going to disappear in phase space of L over E. And the other neutrino red that you didn't have in your source at the very beginnings is going to start manifesting. So what we call this is a probability of oscillation. This is what we call an appearance experiment. And this is a disappearance experiment and typical survival probability. And as a matter of fact, most of our experiments so far, they have been driven by actually disappearance, and only appearance is being started to explode, in the last 4 years, essentially a bit more than that maybe. And in fact, this is basically very important to see CP validation, okay? So if you actually look at how the neutrinos basically worked, you have this weak interaction where you have a certain neutrino, that this is basically your source. The neutrino then is going to propagate, and you're going to have basically this mixing where you actually have to think of the weak eigenstate neutrinos. These are the ones that solve essentially the Lagrangian of the weak eigenstates, essentially. So these are electron muons and taus, and you see them as a non-trivial combination of mass eigenstates. So these are the ones that solve the Schrodinger equation or the Dirac equation more correctly. And these are basically neutrino mass 1, 2, and 3. Okay, and this is going to propagate essentially in vacuum or in matter. It doesn't matter too much. Sometimes it matters, but for this simplistic approach, this is not going to matter a lot. And you can see just simply, you have to see the representation, for example, of a certain neutrino essentially as a combination, linear combination of the other two neutrinos. And you can see that even in biology, you can find beautiful examples of this kind of basically mixing. Although it could be arguable basically about the weighting, but we don't get essentially into that kind of topic right now. Now, neutrinos then they are going to interact in your detector. They may interact essentially with a beta sort of neutrino electron muon tau that could be different or equal. And that's actually what we call typically how we make experiments. So this is basically typically we talk about that one, and that's our source. Okay, so now what do we know as of today regarding neutrino oscillations? So as of now, we have a very stable model with three neutrino, three families, where we have three mixing angles and correspondingly two delta mass squares. So this is the typically one that we call atmospheric, that is becoming, maybe it's a bit dated, to be calling atmospheric, since right now atmospheric neutrinos are no longer really driving, these kind of numbers. And this is the solar. And again, this is driven by Kaplan right now. So it's actually driven by reactive neutrinos. And even though, there is a few exceptions to this model as of now, I wouldn't call it exceptions, I would call it simply some anomalies. Some people are talking about, some possible little issues that there may be some inconsistencies. Very interesting if they were true. As of now, essentially we can only say that they are consistent with uncertainties or issues that are really understanding of the uncertainties regarding that. So I'm going to completely ignore this topic and I'm just going to focus on the mainstream. And now we have basically the three mixing angles, these delta M squares. We have CP validation that is expected in the matrix, because this matrix, upon imposing unitarity, it has to be complex with 3 by 3. And that is basically the sign of the delta M square atmospheric that is known for the solar, and this is unknown. So as of now, we understand things on the few percent level, but very soon, situation is going to change entirely. So everything is going to go thanks to Juno, Dune, and Hyper-K. The entire field is going to be driven by reactors and accelerators. Virtually everything else is going to be, roughly speaking, in terms of precision, not the driving, basically, element. Of course, we get a lot of information from other sources, but it's going to be driven, essentially, the field by reactors and accelerators. And you can see everything is going to go very soon into the per mil level. We expect actually to measure this to the 5 sigma. This is easy to some extent. We think how we can do that. This is a bit more complicated because it depends on the delta on the actual phase. But there you go. And very interestingly, you can see the theta 1.3, that is today's one of the best known basically parameters, is very soon going to be the worst known parameter. And the reason is because the same experiments that have been measuring that up to now, double saw, Diabe, and Reno, actually are driving today's and tomorrow's precision. Nobody knows how to improve that. But I will come back into this topic. So making a long story short, the next decade is going to be about Juno, Dune, and Hyper-K. And as you can see, and actually even the synergies and the interplay between those. And it's about CP validation, but it's about many other things. And you would see this in this seminar, I'm going to try to highlight a few other things. Okay. So it seems that by 2030, I mean, everything would be known. And the question would be, are we done here? I mean, is this it? I mean, can we do physics with neutrinos still? I mean, to really go beyond the standard model? Or, I mean, is it done? So in fact, I mean, as you know, the standard model has been very successful. I mean, some of our frustration as physicists is precisely that it's too successful. We'd like to really find spots where actually this is not fully working, because maybe there is where we might find manifestations of physics beyond the standard model. And we kind of know that something is out there, but we haven't really found the place where this is going to crack in the best possible way. So actually this is our hand. Now, CP validation is one of the key topics that people talk a lot. And I'd like to emphasize in this seminar many other things that would go beyond CP validation, but I'd like to emphasize CP validation because that's stunning. If you actually look at the CP, the Jarchnot basically invariant of the CKM matrix, CP validation is supposed to be small, 10 to the minus 5, whereas basically neutrinos, actually they have the potential to be 3 orders of magnitude even larger. This implies that CP validation in the neutrino could be huge. So once again, neutrinos might be surprising us in terms of basically their phenomenology. And in addition, of course, we need to know the phase. As of now, we don't know the phase. I mean, we are really in the infancy, we would call to measure the phase. But even of today, I mean, even the maximal CP violation, the maximal angle is not ruled out. And this actually was favored by T2K data. Although NOVA data is actually suggesting that maybe things are not as good as that. But we would see, it's very preliminary. I mean, it's just a big uncertainty, it's a statistical uncertainty. So it's too early to say anything for granted. So even though reactors cannot measure CP violation directly, it turns out that all the measurements of CP violation depend on the reactors, because actually this is what T2K can measure in terms of basically CP violation. And this is actually the reactor's measurement of theta 1.3. And in fact, what we actually call our knowledge on CP violation is actually the combination of T2K and the reactor theta 1.3. If you actually didn't have reactor theta 1.3 experiments, T2K alone would not be able even to rule out basically CP conserving solution on that. So as a matter of fact, even though sometimes we highlight T2K and NOVA, and no question about it, without that data, I mean, we wouldn't be what we are. Without the reactor theta 1.3, clean measurement of theta 1.3, we wouldn't be what we are neither. So very importantly, actually, what is happening more and more is that our only way to really improve our knowledge is really exploiting these kind of synergies. And sometimes they are not highlighted essentially in the title of the paper, but you should really be looking into the details, and you would be seeing essentially that this is happening everywhere virtually, and more as time goes. Now, regarding actually the matrix, it's interesting to look at the structure of the matrix, not just basically each angle, but actually what this matrix might be telling us. And this is what I'd like to talk to you a little bit about. So the first thing that we see is that we see large mixing. So this is theta 2.3 and theta 1.3. But we have this small mixing, very puzzling, which is exactly this little bizarre thingy here, that theta 1.3, as a matter of fact. And the question is why this is looking like that. Actually, nobody have a clue. The other thing is that actually CP violation might be huge basically in here. So that's actually very interesting, as I highlighted before. But the big question is, what is this matrix telling us? And as a matter of fact, nobody knows. And the other thing that we need to validate is whether this matrix is actually unitary, because as of now, we assume the unitary. In fact, the fact that we talk about theta 1.3, 2.3, and 1.2 is because we impose the unitarity, but that is an assumption that has not been experimentally validated as of now. No, well, it has been validated to the large precision, if you like, I mean, to large uncertainties, but I mean, really getting competitive there is a very important question, fundamental question, as a matter of fact. Now, let's put side by side the CKA matrix, and you can see this beautiful elegance that the matrix is telling us. It's telling us that basically anything that is off diagonal is disfavored. So this matrix, even though this is very elegant in a way, it has clear structure. I mean, it actually suggests something very clear, a very clear message. Now, this matrix, though, I call it extravaganza. I mean, as a sort of contrast to the elegance, I wouldn't say that this is, well, it makes some people like call it a bit crazy. Some people call it anarchy. Some people call it a little bit of anything. Nobody understands, as a matter of fact, what is this matrix telling us as of now? And this is one of the big challenges to try to understand what's going on. As you know, should we have basically a model that is beyond the standard model, maybe an interesting thing would, that we have to basically understand is how these two things are basically put together in another, basically in a larger model where the standard model is just an effective model. And we are just putting these parameters essentially by hand as we measure them in the experiments. So the elegance of the CKM says there is some mixing, but it's a relatively organized mixing, whereas basically the neutrinos is an absolute, yeah, extravaganza, you name it. Okay, now let's go about a little bit about unitarity, which in my opinion would be probably the last discovery on reacting on neutrinos, as a matter of fact. And the reason is because that, if we saw, of course, non-unitarity, that would be an absolutely stunning manifestation. Let me tell you how we basically go about that. When you actually take this matrix, essentially, you actually impose the unitarity condition. It turned out you actually come down to several equations, independent equations. Some of them tell you that the rows has to be one, the columns has to sum to one. And sometimes you get combinations, these what the people call triangles, essentially the CKM triangles. And this is actually, you need CP validation to do that. But actually it's much more interesting as of now, because in neutrinos, we don't know CP validation yet, to actually consider the rows. So you consider the electron row, the tau row, and the muon row. Now, the muon, the tau, the big problem is that it's very hard to measure neutrino taus. This has been demonstrated by several experiments that they succeeded barely to see the things, but no much more than that. So the precision is very poor, unfortunately. Muons, we know things much better because most of our accelerators are using muons, in fact, as an actual basically beam. But actually what we know the best is with electrons, because this row is actually theta 1,2 and theta 1,3, which actually these two numbers are the best known, I mean, as of now. The main reason is because theta 2,3 suffers from something called the octan ambiguity. So in fact, actually that angle is very large, but actually its largeness actually causes a little bit of an ambiguity that right now we haven't fully resolved. So actually the best row to really start testing that is to use electrons. So this means reactors and solar neutrinos. Okay, let's come back to basically to the matrices, and let's try to pretend for a moment that we have a non-unitary basically situation where we actually consider non-standard neutrinos. But of course, I mean, there could be actually, if you see non-violations of unitarity, you actually could be sensitive to non-standard interactions too. It's very difficult to resolve the two a priori. Let's consider the case of a fourth neutrino. So we actually consider that our CKA matrix, it was a simplified version of another more complex matrix. And let's actually consider just the top row. And we can clearly see a pattern. This term is large, this term is very small, and this term is super mega tiny. Actually, this number is 4 per mil. Okay, that's not uncertainty, that's actually the amplitude. So remarkably, we're able to measure that with some uncertainties, which is even smaller. And in fact, I mean, we would expect, because we haven't seen any manifestation of that, that if this term was ever there, it's going to be following something like that, it's going to be super tiny, okay? And this implies that you need to know things to the level to 10 units in, sorry, 1 in 10 units to the 5 or to the 6. And this, of course, is a huge challenge. And as I mean, I want to emphasize also, when you actually explore the CKM, you would have another problem, is that you have basically quantum chromodynamics, and sometimes there is corrections, radiative corrections, and this gets very, very nasty very quickly. I can show some slides on topic, but I mean, I think you know probably better than I do. Now, if you actually come back to the neutrino and you try to do the same exercise, it turns out that this number is 10%. That's theta 1,3. And that's huge in comparison to 4 per mil. So this implies that if there was any manifestation there, maybe with the per mil level, maybe with even the percent level, we might be able to really be exploring something very interesting. So this is, I mean, basically some people say that to really study unitarity, you need, I mean, 10 units in one unit in 10 to the 5 or so, or units in per mil and per million. And actually that's not necessarily true in the neutrino case. So actually this is a very interesting question that we should be addressing experimentally, of course. But this, I mean, is easy to say, you need to control things to the less than the fermion percent level and really go to the per mil level, okay? Now, if you want to test that case, actually this is a very well-defined experimentally and theoretical problem for neutrinos. The actual prediction is perfect because it's coming from the symmetry. So we know it's one or not, or greater than one. So actually this is very nice. Sometimes you have a prediction that is actually very slippery, that is actually much harder. Experimentally, the precision in principle is accessible. It's challenging, but it's possible. We will talk about that in 1 second. And very nicely, I mean, with neutrinos, we have a direct and clean probe because there is no corrections, these radiative corrections, which are very nasty when it comes to probing CKM and things like that. Now, if we actually saw that, clearly, you get an easy jet to Stockholm directly because this is telling you that we are really probing the standard model up to a level that nobody has really got. This tells you that maybe there are new standard, new particles, new families, or new interactions. Either way, you are really breaking, to a certain extent, our understanding of the standard model as of today. Okay, and interestingly enough, also as I highlighted, we can test it with electron row, but also with immune row. So there is some redundancy to also to validate cross-check, I mean, that actually that's true. So I'm particularly seduced by this particular topic, but okay, I'll take that offline and let me talk to you, tell you where we are regarding reactive neutrinos. What is today the present and the imminent present? So let me tell you about theta 1-3. So theta 1-3 is summarizing this plot that we built for double show. You can see the best measurement, the most precise measurement is this one by Diabet. This was actually 2018 measurement. But it turns out actually the Diabet actually has another measurement, which is the Haruji measurement. These two analyses are slightly correlated. They are not, the statistics is independent, but the analyses are correlated because you're using the same detector and they are some systematics. I don't go into the details. Then there is Reno also basically making, that's the second most precise measurement. And double show in 2006 suggested that theta 1-3 is somewhat larger. And actually it turns out that actually since 2016, actually in 2018, actually Reno and Diabet are slightly moving up. So in fact, in 2019, surprisingly, actually I was very surprised myself, actually theta 1-3 has been moving slightly higher. And as I remind you, basically the theta 1-3, the central value is also very important to understand CP values. And just to give you a little bit of a feeling, if T2K wanted to measure theta 1-3, of course, unfortunately, it's not very easy because there are too many things running in their observables. I mean, that's what makes it beautiful for CP validation, but not very the most precise, if you like, in theta 1-3 phase space. Now, when it comes to these experiments, just to give you a feeling for the precision, these experiments are able to do today handling millions of events, control systematics on the one per mil level, I'm sorry, and to be able to control the energy essentially systematics to less than 1%. That is just absolutely stunning. These are basically the tables with the numbers. I mean, if you have any question, I would come back to that. But you would ask yourself, can we improve that? Because that honestly, I've participated a lot on that. And I tell you that even myself, I still sometimes I wonder about this one per mil systematics. Do we really believe we understand things to the one per mil level? This is very hard physics. Now, if you wanted to improve, I mean, in this business, well, getting more statistics is actually not that difficult. Just make your detector bigger. Actually, these detectors, so theta 1-3 detectors were rather small. So that's easy. We can go to millions and even tens of millions. That's relatively easy. It costs you money, but it's easy. It's feasible. We know how to do that. Unfortunately, controlling systematics on a few units in 10 to the 4, that very honestly, I don't think anybody in this planet knows how to do that. And that actually is very challenging. And the question is this the end of the reactive neutrino precision? And as I'm going to show you later on, the answer is no. There are strategies, and this is actually what this seminar is about too. There you go. Now, when it comes to theta 1-3, today's knowledge, actually, if you ask anybody out there, they will tell you that it's impossible to improve theta 1-3. And what I'm going to tell you in this seminar is that we know how to do it. And this is going to be shown in a few minutes' time. Now, let's talk to theta 1-2. That was the other important component for the neutrino electron side. So now that brings us basically to China, and that's actually the only place where we can improve that. We have this huge detector, Juno, that is going to build essentially within 50 kilometers baseline to two of the most powerful reactor complexes in the world. This is actually very close to Hong Kong. Hong Kong is just here, roughly speaking. And so this is a huge detector. taking a huge amount of basically of reactor, basically neutrinos. I mean, 600 meters underground is a new laboratory being built. And making a long story short, we hope to start taking data by 2022. This detector is one of the, I mean, essentially it's of the size of super Camucanda, but now you put PMTs, photocathode, in every single millimeter that is left. So in fact, there is large photomultipliers that drive essentially the stochastic calorimetry for the control of the energy. And there is some small photomultipliers, actually this is our idea, driven by Europe to a large extent, that is about to control the systematics, but also help essentially the physics at different levels. So actually it's like if we have two detectors within one single detector, and that actually has advantages because we can actually see the oscillation of theta 1, 2 with two independent readouts, okay? Of course, it's the same physics, so actually the statistical basically turn is fully correlated. So what we are actually doing with this is validating in a hyper-precision level the systematics of the control of the calorimetry, and you use the large PMTs that give you even information. These wiggle if theta 1, 2, with theta 1, 3, and this is basically what people, Juno uses to measure mass ordering, but we can measure theta 1, 2 in two with two independent readouts that allow us to control to absolutely the up with an amazing precision to the per minute level to understand really theta 1, 2 and delta M square solar. And why we do that? Because actually, it turns out that we need a per mil precision because Juno is able, is going to improve essentially from SNOW and Super K by almost an order of magnitude in precision in terms of theta 1, 2, and is going to improve delta M square also by almost an order of magnitude in the other side. And the bad news is that there is nobody that is going to check Juno. So this is why within Juno, we are pushing very heavily to get as much redundancy as possible to be able to really understand ourselves, our own systematics, because really controlling per mil physics on a, it was hard to do it on small detectors like double saw, but doing it on a 20 kiloton detector, things are getting a little bit harder. So this is why we're actually building this redundant system that we call a small PMT system, if I've been leading that effort. Now, when it comes to theta 1, 2, in fact, I mean, beyond Juno, I think it's impossible to go. This is to the per mil level, but this is the theta 1, 2 with neutrinos. And now, interestingly enough, this is the only parameter that maybe we can measure with the solar. This means that we can measure the neutrino and then an anti-neutrino version of that. And if we're able to do that, this implies that we're testing CPT invariants directly. And this is one of the most beautiful ways to do it. And we'll talk about that in 1 second. But already I hinted, I mean, something that we're going to do. Now, the big issue up to here, it was a story of success. Now, when it comes to understanding the absolute flux, this is when things get very, very hard. As a matter of fact, the situation is very nasty. So it turns out when we started doing theta 1-3 experiments, I mean, that the data to Monte Carlo prediction, so in other words, how good the prediction is, that essentially everything, to make a long story short, is screwed up to the level of 10%. We don't understand the normalization and we don't understand the shape. Some people right now are claiming that this difference in normalization is a call for the sterile. Very honestly, I don't subscribe to that point of view. I subscribe to the point of view that before I talked about something like that, I should understand my source better. And since nobody in this planet right now can prove that we don't understand this source any better, nor in normalization or the shape, I think it's a little bit daring to really be talking about that, I mean, in terms of a sterile. Of course, right now people have changed a little bit the logic, and now people are using basically relative analysis because we know that really the one thing that we now know is that we don't know nuclear reactors to the level. 6% is basically my number. I definitely don't believe this number that right now is kind of the official number for some people. And I think that we can conservatively say that we understand a nuclear reactor to the level of 10%. But 5% is kind of the level. If you think about it, this is great. This is not, I mean, this is a fantastic. I mean, understanding in absolute a source to the level of a few percent is an absolute achievement. Now, some people just thought that we understood things to the 2% level, and I think that just turns out to be wrong. Or at least we cannot prove that this is right, which is a synonym sometimes. Now, we know actually the absolute position of that to the per mil level. So we actually know this value to the per mil level, but since we don't know the prediction to the level of 7% or so, there is an offset here of 6-7%, the only thing that we can say it humbly enough is that we don't understand the nuclear reactor as much as we thought that we did. And c'est la vie. Yeah? And now improving that, because that's maybe what you're wondering, And I very honestly have to say, with a lot of embarrassment, we just don't know how to do that, at least not to first order. There are some funky ideas out there, but this would take me another hour of discussion. And as of now, I would basically say that we don't know really how to improve that. Not even if Schreckenbach actually measured, remeasured, the electron, from the decay of the reactor and so on and so forth. I mean, it's a very tough problem, I'm afraid. Absolute problems are very tough problems. So now, basically, let me show you what we know about the unitarity, which implies basically putting all that information together. We know this very well. We know this very well. But as unsurprisingly, we don't know that very well. And to understand the unitarity, we need to know the flags. Unsurprisingly enough, these are basically the limits from Unokawa et al., a colleague of mine I work very closely to. And you can see basically our understanding basically of the unitarity, basically, that you can express it in this manner, essentially. So this is 1.5% if you believe you understand the reactor flux to 3%, which I don't at all, nor they do. So that's the reason why they actually explore 6% level. So what we can say right now is that we can know the unitarity on the electron row, which is the best that we know so far, to the level of the 3%, is totally basically driven by the flux uncertainty. And this implies, because Juno is not going to improve that, despite the beautiful measurement on theta 1-2, it's impossible to measure that, to improve that measurement even with Juno. So we need to really work on absolute. And the main problem is that so far, we have been playing this game of multiple detectors. And what we have been doing by doing that is actually postponing this problem. And now if we really want to improve basically unitarity, I mean, this implies that we need to tackle this problem head on. And this is actually only easy to say, very hard to do. Okay, regarding mass ordering, what are we going to know regarding with the reactors? Well, it turns out, if you actually look at today's papers with the combined analysis, that we know that normal, is suggested, is favored, normal mass ordering is favored to 3 sigma. Okay, this is a combination, it's an aggregate of several experiments. Now, Juno is going to come by 2028 providing 3 sigma. Wow, that's a little bit scary because you said, well, or today I know already almost 3 sigma. Okay, yes, D3 sigma is much better than D3 sigma maybe. But nonetheless, in 8 years time, we're gonna go only 3 sigma. And the question is, does it matter? Would it be too late, too little? Would that be ever enough? And we actually basically thought about very carefully. So we actually just wrote a paper about that. And we tried to address the question, when are we going to really know mass ordering to the 5 sigma level? Which experiments in the minimal set are going to matter? And what is the physics that really is playing, in this role? And this is what our paper was about. And I just summarized very, very quickly. It turns out that if you just combine Juno, Nova, and T2K, T2K being almost a priori blinded to mass ordering, but Nova is actually very sensitive to mass ordering, they cannot do it. But if you combine Juno, you can actually get to the 5 sigma level, roughly speaking, with 1% uncertainty, which is very close to what we have today in the delta M squared atmospheric. If you improve the delta M squared atmospheric, this just basically gets better and better and better. So in fact, we, to our greatest surprise, we realized that actually just Juno, Nova, and T2K, and we are virtually down. We actually have basically a very high chances to get the 5 sigma basically by 228. Nova and T2K would stop earlier. So this actually would follow totally the Juno schedule. And it seems that Juno actually combining with Nova and T2K is going to give us the good news for that. And this is beautiful because Dune is an absolute beautiful machine for mass ordering. And it's very nice to have basically a 5 sigma measurement from these guys combined and compared to Dune that actually is come along. And we have now two things that can be compared one another because there is no model out there that predicts what the mass ordering should be. Even more, Dune is going to give you 5 sigma mass ordering using matter effects, whereas Juno can actually do the vacuum oscillations alone, and we can get to the 5 sigma level, as we prove in the paper. And the reason is very simple. There is a stunning synergy. So this is the sensitivity of mass ordering of Juno, and we are able to go about 5 sigma just by the improvement of the atmospheric delta M square. This boosting is just the beautiful, probably one of the most elegant synergies that I've seen in neutrino oscillations, and it's between accelerators and reactors. They are just boosting their sensitivity by combining their information. So the details are in the paper. I skip the details here because otherwise it would take me too long. But now I can go come back to basically my original motivation when we started thinking about that. Would Juno have a role in that? And the answer is absolutely. Juno is the only experiment that could give us vacuum mass ordering alone and will make 5 sigma simply by boosting with the delta M squared information. But this is as good as basically T2K measuring CP violation using the reactor theta 1-3. It's actually the same thing, but just the other way around. So again, it's about combining the information and really going well beyond. Now, let me take you to the future. And of course, that implies basically some uncertainties intrinsically. Now, right now, we have this beautiful experiment, Juno, being built. Right now, Hyper-K also being built, and Dune. In fact, right now, there is the largest excavation in the planet happening for neutrino. I mean, these are the largest experiments in probably in the history of neutrinos, and both of them are right now making essentially underground laboratories. One of the things you might notice is whether we are left without neutrino oscillations experiments or leading called a flagship experiment in the next decade. Of course, I mean, there is many Europeans here. So we are doing physics, I mean, in a different way. But I mean, still, I mean, this is an interesting question. I mean, something that we Europeans, I think we should think about a little bit. Now, one big lesson that we know, and I can tell you in the most painful way, is that making things civil construction close to a nuclear reactor is really not the right way to go. I cannot recommend it less, as a matter of fact. It's very especially if you're building, I mean, a nuclear and detector, you're doing an underground detector with TNT, and it happens to be Fukushima basically exploded, I mean, exactly the same time. It turned out that actually putting TNT close to a nuclear reactor became super unpopular, I mean, solution. So I really don't recommend people to go that way. This is so bad that in fact, we have realized that actually the only way to go forward is to invent another detection technique. And this, I'd like to say that this is a joke, but actually it's not. This is actually how Liquido was born, or at least how I was motivated to invent Liquido, because to a large extent, I was desperately thinking, how can we improve nuclear reactors? I mean, in that context, we definitely don't want to be digging big things in there. So this detector, as you would see it, is specialized on tagging the antimatter positron. So this is what is important for the case of the nuclear reactors, but you would see you can do much more. And this is great because actually our backgrounds are typically mundane stuff, just radioactivity and some cosmic stuff. But I mean, to a large extent, this is stuff that we can actually know. If this is positron antimatter, we can actually do this very easily. You will see why in 1 second. So in fact, our detectors today, I mean, Davoso, Juno, the state of the art, what we actually see when we have a positron electron gamma is what I'm showing to you, and I'm not joking. We see nothing. We see essentially a bulb of information. All the information is, roughly speaking, lost. Making a long story short, all this information is lost throughout the detection method. And this, I'm going to make a statement, and I'm going to prove it, not fully, because of the seminar limitations, it has to do with transparency. So what Liquido can do is this. We're able to see that a positron looks very different from an electron. I'm going to explain that in 1 second. And it looks very different from a gamma. And this gamma is quantum. This is quantum, 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 and then photoelectric at the end. I think you understand if this is a gamma doing that, these are gammas, are annihilation, and it's exactly doing the same thing. So what we are achieving with Liquido, most importantly, is an imaging machine that is able to handle things on the centimeter scale, and it gives you precision on the vertex on the probably the millimeter scale. We are basically doing the R&D associated with that. But the Monte Carlo, this is full Gen 4 Monte Carlo, tell us, this is easy. Now we need to validate it experimentally because I don't believe Gen 4, as you know, Gen 4 can give you whatever you like if you tune it well enough. I mean, not everything, but at least, I mean, you have to be very careful. You have to take with a grain of salt that. So Liquido is about, I mean, essentially exploiting, actually developing this particular ID, using that. But now that your liquid scintillator doesn't have to be transparent, it's going to be opaque, you're going to see that, we can actually dope it. You can actually dope it brutally, because now you can actually do things that you couldn't do when you have to go transparent, because transparency was a fundamental, basically, limitation in terms of basically don't put anything in the detector, otherwise, roughly speaking, you screw up the transparency. Okay, so actually that's basically sort of that sets a new framework for playing with detectors. And in fact, it turns out, not surprisingly, this is our signal and those are our backgrounds, and you just can't see it by eye, that you can see it. Of course, there are fluctuations on these mechanisms because this is basically quantum. So this is, you cannot assume that all the positrons look alike, but nonetheless, you can clearly see that actually you can see, and they have the same energy. So actually you can discriminate them with calorimetry first, and then you can basically compare them apples to apples in terms of calorimetry and distinguish. Okay, let's go into the details now very quickly. So this is actually what a positron looks like in Liquido. This is an opaque scintillator, and this is a transparent scintillator. And the amazing thing, and this is super counterintuitive, is that with transparency, you see less than actually with opacity,
because what we actually do with opacity, we are forcing the light to stay locally. And this effectively, we do that without any segmentation. Segmentation, particularly the MEV, is very actually, I don't recommend it very honestly, unless you really know, you really you do, you know what you're doing. I mean, there are many, many, many reasons why segmentation is very bad at MEV, particularly radio purity is very bad. Okay, so here we have achieved for the first time something that it looked impossible. We're able to confine the light, to force the light to stay locally, essentially, without any segmentation or pixelization strategy whatsoever. This we call self-segmentation, and this mechanism is stochastic. And you will see it's very simple, it's bread and butter physics. Now, before I told you about the bread and butter physics, I mean, let me tell you what this looked like. So this would be double show data. Okay, we have one of the best signal to backgrounds in the planet for a 30 meter detector underground. We have a 30-to-1 basically signal to background. This is really good, as a matter of fact. We have few events per day in terms of the background. And with Liquido, if we extrapolate it, I mean, I'll go into details if you want it. If we actually are able to tag the positron, you'd be going essentially to a scale where your signal to background will go well above 100, actually more like 1,000. Assuming the extrapolation correctly, actually even more, as a matter of fact, these are numbers, I'm trying to be very conservative. So people, I mean, there is room essentially for an error here. And the background basically has knocked down essentially from few per day to few per year. So this is like a double beta experiment, but now in the full spectra, there is no region of interest or something like that. So this is just amazing because that tells us that if you're able to do this kind of signal to background, I mean, this means to some extent, you will start getting away from overparting. You don't need to go deep underground. And that, of course, means millions and millions in terms of consequences, of course. I mean, you might want to keep the signal to background at that level because you want to do super funky physics. I mean, that's your choice. But you might get away without much overburden. I think overburden, a little bit of overburden is always good because there is an electromagnetic component of cosmics, but very little is probably good enough. So now, what is Liquido based about? Is about? So actually, it's very simple physics. It's the same physics basically that basically force the light come back to you when you have some fog in front of you. Actually, it's not reflected; it's a scatter back. And but nonetheless, it's the same physics. Actually, the same physics where you see essentially the lights essentially in the fog. So that's how Liquido works. Super simple. So it comes down essentially that now your photons, instead of basically coming back, they actually going to do a random walk in your detector. What we're going to do is increase scattering brutally by four orders of magnitude. And this implies that your photons no longer go away, essentially to the infinity, but they actually remain locally. Of course, now the question is, how do you get the light? And we get the light by putting fibers in this region. And now we collect essentially, instead of having basically washing all this information, the information remains locally and is self-segmented. You don't have any segmentation whatsoever. You just use an opaque mechanism to do that. And you will see how we do that. This mechanism typically exploits my scattering. There is some Rayleigh scattering, but my scattering is really the way, right way to go. You will see why. And this is the scattering of the clouds, and this is the scattering of the sky. This is why the clouds are white and the milk is white. And this is basically why the sky is blue. So this is actually the basis of this stochastic scattering that we use for Liquido. In fact, the my scattering is so well understood that you can find papers where they use my scattering to understand the samples. You can actually see this is a milky business. You can see the different properties of milk or simply vitamins, and you can actually understand even the different samples. And that's exactly how we want Liquido to look. There is no chromatism. There is no chromatic difference. Although sometimes color could be beautiful, but I'm going to take that offline entirely should you have a question, and then we can talk about that. Okay, so this is, brings me to the what I call the theorem of Liquido. If you have anything that basically has a lot of scattering, you may call it milky, cloudy, or waxy, and it produces light, scintillator or Cherenkov, it doesn't matter if it's gas, liquid, or solid, this is Liquido, and everything that I'm going to show you works. To a larger extent, to a lesser extent, but it works. It's the same physics. Okay, so this is how we make those images I showed to you. So we make those images by putting a very packed, basically, lattice of fibers. These are wave-shifting fibers. And we just basically put in one direction. But of course, in this geometry, you can put different directions. You can put up to three axes. You can prove easily yourself that actually you don't need three. With two is more than enough. And you can actually just make it the opacity, just basically forces every single quantum essentially to remain in a little ball. And you just reconstruct all that information. And again, this was the image I showed before. Okay, so we need fibers. So we actually win. These fibers are well understood. So these are B3 fibers of Kudarai in our case for now. There is also Saint-Gobain fibers that we're exploring. And we have to basically bring the light to silicon PMs. But before we do that, we actually have to make a new scintillator. And this is actually a picture of our new scintillator. Our new scintillator looks like milk. In fact, we have woxified, we have introduced basically paraffin into the scintillator, which is also hydrogen and carbon, and beautifully, we have solidified. And this is beautiful. If you don't believe how beautiful liquid scintillator is to become solid, you can go to Gran Sasso and ask people basically whether they like liquid scintillator to leak into the water. And you will see that solidifying it is actually very good for many, many, many reasons. I mean, Gran Sasso and any elsewhere. Because also this implies your detector actually is not basically moving in terms of convection. This is also very good for some backgrounds, for example, becoming from radon and things like that. And also because this means that you can dope it and you don't have to care. You use suspension now to keep your dope, as a matter of fact. So this is actually very good. Let me speed up because I'm realizing my timing, my timing is a bit tight. So we also basically built dedicated electronics, very fast electronics. You can see even a single pin of a silicon pin has been digitized up to the level of almost indecent level of precision, because we are interested in really understanding this information in the front of this liquid scintillator. This is the de-excitation of the scintillator. And the point is that there is a lot of physics here that never been able to be used because PMTs were very slow. So it turns out that actually liquid works like a light TPC with a 4π time of flight system. Essentially, if you think about it, careful enough, you realize that actually that's what we built. We didn't realize this at the very beginning. I love to say that we were conscious about it, but the reality is that's what we have. So we now go from Gen4, this paradigm, to that paradigm, and it's very easy to prove it in with Gen4. If you look in Gen4 more carefully with the photons, you're moving to from rays. These are your photons, and these are the fibers. You can see it. And you're moving into this sort of, I like to think of an ephemeral, basically foam of optical photons. You can see the photons no longer behave as you used to think they do, but nonetheless, that's absolutely stunning. In fact, this is how you contain the light and you increase the light level because these photons are going to keep on trying to be collected by the fiber by themselves. Nobody forces them, as a matter of fact. Now, I'm going to show you something that I shouldn't show you, but of course, this is otherwise, it would be worth, keeping me on this seminar, is I'm going to show you the first data, super quick and dirty data from our second prototype running with muons on water Cherenkov. So you see basically with water, you see just Cherenkov. And you scintillator, you see the Cherenkov plus the liquid scintillator. These pulses have been, of course, normalized to one. But what you can see is the beautiful Cherenkov light, basically here. This is not too surprising. It's kind of a delta function. This has been many muons with no the same acceptance. But what you can see here, and that is stunning, is that now you see the scintillator tail, and you see that there is a unicorn behavior, and that is actually your Cherenkov. You can actually identify Cherenkov light and scintillator light with your finger, as a matter of fact. This is not even calibrated data. This is just to show you in the most quick and dirty and preliminary way, we can actually distinguish Cherenkov and scintillation light just with your finger. And this implies that now we can actually use Cherenkov as a counting mechanism, so you can count particles, as a matter of fact. So this is actually very, very beautiful. And this is why we are very interested in the front of the pulse, and this is something that you couldn't have achieved easily with photomultipliers. They're too slow. Now, if you want more details, please go to our paper that is supposed to basically come out very soon in Nature Physics Communication. But otherwise, there is also our scintillator paper, and you can go into details. But let me come back now to reactive neutrinos. And I'm sorry, I'm a little bit tight in time. So I'm going to push a little bit through. So what Liquido can do for us? So let's go back to our beautiful European best reactor site so far. And it turns out, actually, we have these two beautiful reactors, but it turns out that we have a huge site here. And this is a secret that not many people know. And let me tell you about that secret because it's time to unravel these. So this is actually basically the entrance to that huge, basically, hole. And as you can see, people have been working on that very heavily because what it turned out to be is that there was a nuclear reactor during the 60s that was running there, essentially, and in fact was the first PWR reactor that was built between Belgium and France at the time. In fact, there is two caverns right now of the size of Super Kamikaze, if you put them together, 50 kilotons effectively of water. But either way, it's already huge caverns. And in fact, I mean, the big problem of these caverns, they are beautiful. I mean, you have basically two caverns for free, essentially built already, ready to work, and close to two of the most powerful reactors in the planet, which are Shaw. As a matter of fact. So actually this opens an amazing opportunity of physics in France and of course in Europe and the world, because as a matter of fact, this is for everybody in a way. Big problem of that, the overburden is absolutely deplorable. I mean, for our current technology, this is a killer. You can do nothing on that. You can just basically congratulate yourself, but nothing but that. This is, I mean, unfortunately useless with our current technology. But if you have a technology that is able to clean your backgrounds with this kind of overburden, now we're playing a different game, of course. Now, this is just to give you a feeling for our Super K, how it would look like. And I guess basically you might be wondering in one way or another, am I suggesting something called Super Show or like? And the answer is yes. Let me get you in the details. These are the caverns that were built in the 60s. And this is actually the only pictures that you can really see, because otherwise there are many layers and the reactor is being dismantled. I've been there for a few times. And this is actually the foot of the footprint of the reactor. And this is where they were built. This is 40 meters. This is of the size of almost basically Notre Dame in Paris. So you can call this basically Notre Dame des Choux, if you like. And this is actually the other cavern. So actually this implies that actually while Hyper-K, Juno and Dune, they are being built, actually the caverns are already built in Europe. Maybe the question is, can we do physics there? And indeed, we can actually put a detector here, and we can actually put near detectors here. And this implies that we can do something very powerful that I already highlighted 1 year ago in this talk, so I'm not going to go into the details, but we can demonstrate that we can make the best measurement of theta 1-3 by almost an order of magnitude better as of today's knowledge, essentially. So one order of magnitude better, roughly speaking, than today's Diabe. And we can also make the best measurement on delta M squared EE. So this is actually the atmospheric measurement. So comparable essentially to Juno and so on. So these are already very nice measurements. And this implies that if we go back to CP violation, imagine how beautiful it would be to do this measurement, but now with using a theta 1-3 that is an order of magnitude better, and instantaneously, just with the same data, T2K and NOVA today, you would be improving essentially your constraints by a factor, non-negligible factor, okay? Of course, Dune and Hyper-K are coming along, but these, of course, these kind of measurements are just keep on improving also Dune and Hyper-K. So as a matter of fact, this is fundamental information for Dune and Hyper-K, and even for Juno, as a matter of fact. Now, the detectors are so large now, if you consider the size, that you can actually look at the sun. You can actually consider basically a sun telescope, and you can look at solar neutrinos again, and this is basically what you could do. So what you see here is theta 1-2, and theta 1-3, this is basically today's knowledge. You see Camland, you see basically solar neutrinos, and this is the reactor theta 1-3, which is slices, and this is today's solution. Now, very soon, Juno is gonna come along and it's going to make such a precise measurement in theta 1-2 that you can see that it's going to improve in this level by almost an order of magnitude. That I already told you about. But now what would happen if we had Super Show? Well, first thing is that we would slice these even better with theta 1-3 by an order of magnitude. And it turns out our preliminary calculations are not showing, but I can explain it later on. We can actually measure with the solar, basically of the level of that level, and the detector is big enough, 10 kilotons on the level, and we can actually make a competitive measurement with Juno. But this is neutrinos and no antineutrinos. This implies CPT invariance can be probed directly, not indirectly, but directly. Not assume anymore. So this is the minimum that we can consider. We can consider the world best measurements in theta 1-3 and delta M square. One of the world best measurements definitely for neutrinos in theta 1-2. We are really studying delta M squared. It's not very easy because actually there is no distortion when you use solar neutrinos. CPT invariance basically tested directly, unitarity tested directly, supernova neutrinos, antineutrinos, and everything. Proton decay essentially also can be tested, and I'll show you in 1 second. And so there is quite a menu, and this just keeps on growing, as a matter of fact. So this is our preliminary studies on Super Short. Now, before I basically stop, I'd like to basically give you a little bit of a teaser of what Liquido could do if you actually go to even GeV neutrino interaction. So this is an antineutrino, nui. So you get a positron, essentially, and you get a neutron. So you can actually see all that. You can see the beautiful track, essentially, of your pion in your production. This is a charge current interaction, essentially. You can see the powerful, basically, electromagnetic information. You can see basically these are high energy gammas essentially from your electric interaction. If you magnetize it, you would see that this bends basically up and down. You actually see the tracking part of the electromagnetic shower. So you can actually basically see the sign just because of that. This halo basically is positrons, gammas, low energy stuff that if you see it at the 1 MeV level, imagine when you have 1 GeV. Now you can actually basically see the detector has a large, basically low Z. So this is why the events are huge, enormous. This is basically 3 meters almost of an event, essentially. And you can see that the stop immune that is going to come from the pi minus, so you can actually tag the sign of that without the need of even magnetic field. So you get a Michel electron or a Michel positron, and you can do that. But also you can measure even the energy of the neutron, the outgoing neutron, which is fundamental to understand the interactions essentially of this particle, of this neutrino. And this is fundamental to understand the energy of the neutrino, not just the energy, visible energy, but the energy of the neutrino, and to understand the type of interaction that actually happens, because sometimes there is not just a charge current interaction, sorry, quasi-elastics, but there could be other interactions going on. So you can actually measure the neutron, and this is giving you the energy of the neutron. Duty cycle, because this is working at the speed of light. And this implies essentially you get calorimetry to the per min level in terms of basically the stochastic term. Of course, you have to control your non-stochastic terms, but this is something another discussion for later on. So what you can see is that Liquido with liquid scintillator actually is able to provide information at the level of liquid argon TPCs. But liquid argon TPCs, because argon is not very good for neutrons, cannot do that actually very well. So actually even you can do the neutrons and you have a target with carbon and you have a target with hydrogen, which is actually something, the holy grail for interaction people, looking into that for near detectors. So clearly you can see that Liquido would be able to provide you some beautiful information, of that level. This could be atmospheric neutrinos. And imagine what you get if you get a proton decay. So this is the channel of super K, pi zero. You can see just by hand, there is interaction. This is the electron, the positron, the electromagnetic shower. And essentially you can see that you can identify essentially a proton decay with your finger. Okay, just to basically wrap up, I'm not going to go into the details. You can see the possible impact of super show would be enormous, and it would improve essentially theta-1-3, that would improve CP violation, and also tests unitarity, but I don't have time to go into the details. My apologies, I went a little bit beyond the time. So indeed, super show is still a question mark that we are considering heavily here, and it appears so far to be a stunning opportunity that more and more seem to be even better. Actually, we are looking into that. So this was our visit last month, actually working with EDF and CNRS. This is our team, as a matter of fact, actually already exploring and discussing with EDF. We're actually in the process of negotiating the possibility of using recycling essentially that site. So this is actually looking something very exciting as of now. So neutrinos back to Europe? We don't know yet, but we hope so. And that's the end of my seminar. Thank you very much. So I hope I've convinced you that reactor neutrinos remain an absolutely beautiful and fundamental tool to continue to do explorations on neutrino oscillations for today and for the future. And I think Liquido would be particularly basically the key to basically empower that, not only the reactor neutrino way, but potentially well beyond. And of course, we continue working with Liquido, the R&D associated to that, to make sure that this works as expected. I stop here. Thank you very much. And my apologies for the little delay.
That's fine, Anatel. Thank you very much for this new and very exciting research. I will pause the recording and then restart it for the questions.